You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons RAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello again, Richard.
Hello, on the other side of the Giro, Lionel.
It's all over for another year.
Bereft.
We're bereft. And the countdown to the Tour de France is on. But the women's tour comes
all right.
First.
Yeah, don't get ahead of ourselves here, Lionel. We're still looking back on the Giro d'Italia. It's the day after. Yeah, I left Daniel Freib in Verona yesterday, but not before I got him to answer a few of your listeners' questions. A few of your questions, dear listeners. And we'll hear some of the answers that Daniel and I gave to those questions in part two of this podcast. But you and I, Lionel, will answer some questions in part one and then again in part three.
How was Daniel when you left him in Verona? Was he Romeo or just the one gentleman of Verona left on
his
own
there?
He
was definitely Romeo because his girlfriend had arrived, as he revealed in the podcast on Sunday night in Verona. So definitely Romeo. Disappearing off in our Alfa Romeo Juliet car that we had been driving around Italy for 3 weeks. Hadn't really cleaned it up for his girlfriend arriving.
Is it still full of copies of La Gazzetta dello Sport and his running kit?
Yeah, there's a pizza box there as well and a lot of empty bottles. He wouldn't let me throw anything out because he likes to recycle everything, which is great and admirable. Juliet, we shall call her Juliet, did roll her eyes a little at that one when she saw the back seat of the car.
Oh, dear. Different rules at the tour, isn't it? Different
submerged
rules.
Submerged beneath the rubbish. Hopefully she made it out again. Anyway, they're off for a lovely week's holiday. Then Daniel's off to the Dauphiné. And you and I are reflecting on the Giro. We're going to, as I say, hear some questions. We're going to have a little package from riders who I spoke to on the final day of the Giro, veterans, if I can use that word, of the 2017 baby Giro. I mentioned a few nights ago that I'd noticed that the top four from the 2017 baby Giro were all riding this year's senior Giro, which is quite exceptional, really. And spoke to them in Verona on Sunday. So we'll hear from them later in this episode. I don't know where to go now, Lionel. Can we have the tale of the tapper, please?
Well, there's no tapper today, I'm afraid, Richard. No, you'll have to get Orla's extravagant story of the stage cranked up again when the women's tour kicks off at the weekend.
Daily coverage of the women's tour. Orla's stories of the stages are something else.
Epic, aren't they? They're like sort
of all the cultural references. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like kind of epic poems almost.
I've already got a tapper in my legs today, Lionel, because I cycled my little boy down to nursery, two and a half mile journey there and then 2.5 miles back. Unfortunately, I punctured en route, so it was a very bumpy ride for the wee fella.
Did Movistar suddenly swing over and give you a bike?
And no Maxiandri on hand. Where is he when you need him? The ninth man, he described himself as, of the Movistar team, Maxiandri.
Of course he did. Yeah.
But no, he wasn't. He wasn't there. There was no team car, sadly.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons RAM.
Comfort and confidence is incredibly important. My name's Jimmy Whelan and I ride for EF Education First Pro Cycling. Obviously comfort comes first, but they also have to look good as well, and I think Rafa have nailed it this time around. The bib shorts in Australia reacted perfectly to the hot weather. In the brutal 50 degree temperatures, and I raced over 1,000 kilometres in a week with them, and they were perfect. The Rafa bib shorts are the best bib shorts in the world.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa, who, have helped us travel around Italy for the last 3 weeks and bring you nightly podcast from the Giro d'Italia. We are very grateful indeed to them. And over the last week, we heard a conversation between Paul Smith and Simon Mottram, the designer Paul Smith, and Simon, the founder of Rafa and the chief executive, about a new range of Paul Smith designed clothing for Rafa Cycling Club. It's really, really beautiful. Have a look at it at rafa.cc. And it was an enjoyable conversation to listen to bits of. We had one question from somebody asking whether they could hear the whole conversation. We'll maybe ask them about that.
I think that's the plan, yeah. But I don't know what's with that at the moment. But I think that is the plan. We'll put out an extended edit of the conversation between Sir Paul Smith and Simon Mottram at some point.
Oh, well,
or maybe Rafa will. I'm afraid, you know, the first question on the press conference has completely stumped me.
Let's move on to another one and hope we've got some answers to the next one.
Hi guys, this is Andrea from Milano, Italy, and thoroughly enjoyed your coverage of the Giro. And I have a question about Simon Yates, seeing that you are very close to Matt White, probably his best friend, right? And I was wondering if you have any inside information or if you just heard rumors about why Simon performed so poorly in this Giro, and also if you have any clue about what his next goals might be in the remaining part of the season. Looking forward to the next episode.
Well, Simon Yates, it's a mystery, isn't it? I mean, that's 2 years in a row he's had a puzzling Giro d'Italia, if you like. Remember last year he was in a what looked like a very strong position in the final week, having built up all this this advantage over Tom Dumoulin, Chris Froome and the others. And then he collapsed in the final couple of days and said even months afterwards that he didn't really know what happened. And this year, I guess, well, towards the end of the Giro, he was saying the same again, that he doesn't really know what happened. It's strange in the sense that he seemed, as we know, so confident going into the race. And I think that's what he genuinely felt. It looked to me like he'd played a blinder in the build-up to the race, riding preparation races but not going for the overall, clearly just using them as part of his training blocks for the Giro. We spoke to Matt White in Bologna, and he said that was exactly the idea, that he didn't need the affirmation of, you know, an overall win at Paris-Nice, for example. He just needed to kind of test himself on the odd day. And if you remember, at Paris-Nice, he won a time trial there. So all the signs look very good, but it's strange, isn't it? Because Adam Yates, his twin brother, has been having an outstanding season this year, and they do seem to be on a kind of seesaw, the pair of them. One's up, when one's up, the other one's down. And last year, Adam Yates had a very disappointing year, while Simon Yates won the Vuelta in the end. And this year, it looks like the balance has gone the other way, and it's Adam who's in the ascendancy and is going to the Tour de France as the team's leader. But yeah, I would say that Simon Yates, from what we know from speaking to him and to Matt White, doesn't really know why he wasn't able to contend for the victory at the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, there's a question on our Facebook discussion group from Mark Gray, who asked the question, if you were Simon Yates, would you prefer his 2018 Giro, where, of course, he won three stages and was in the pole position to win the race before crumbling, as he puts it, and finishing 22nd overall at the end of the race, or being relatively anonymous this time and finishing 8th overall? And I suppose, well, I mean, the people who've responded to that, and my own answer is that, well, you'd much rather the 2018 race, surely, even if it ended in disappointment. I mean, he was one of the most important riders every day for 2.5 weeks. He had the jersey, he looked good, he won stages. It was all there in the palm of his hand, and all, you know, we talked about this, didn't we, last year? You know, all he had to do was close his fingers around the prize, and it was his. But of course, it's never quite as easy as that. Whereas this year, he never really seemed to, you know, other than the opening time trial in Bologna, where I thought that was the absolutely perfect result for him. You know, on the coattails of Primoz Roglic, and I thought, as turned out, Roglic, having been so good at the Tour of Romandy, it's a long way from there to the end of the Giro, and so it turned out for Roglic. But you know, Yates didn't then sort of push on in the key parts of the race, and really was caught out in the time trial at San Marino, wasn't he? And on the rest day when Daniel and I went to see him, you know, he was puzzling, mulling over what might have gone wrong, why he couldn't get the performance out of his legs, because he felt that the performance was in there, but he couldn't get it out. And that's a different thing to not having the legs. I know this getting a bit sort of, a bit vague here, but he felt like all the preparation had been right up to the start of the race. And we talked about this idea that perhaps the relative lack of intensity in that first week perhaps left it, made it difficult for him to get the performance out in the time trial, which then put him very much on the back foot. But then when he looked like he needed to drag himself back into contention, he again didn't quite have it. Probably the most impressive couple of days were the penultimate weekend, weren't they? The Stage de Courmayeur, where he's second, and the Stage de Como, where he's third. And I thought then, well, maybe now he can haul himself a few more places up in the difficult final few stages, but that didn't really happen either. And yeah, it was interesting to see him at the end talking about how disappointed he was to not put together the race that he wanted, having effectively built probably his whole season around this. The question now is what he will do from here. I would assume, although I don't know for sure, but I would assume he will go to the Vuelta and try to repeat what he did last year, I guess.
Hi, this is Adam in Sheffield. With this year's Giro ending in a TT as opposed to a GC procession, does the team think there could or should be more TTs to finish a Grand Tour? And has there ever been an opposite to a prologue, an epilogue, say, to mark the final day before the final stage? I've really enjoyed this year's coverage. Looking forward to July already. Thanks.
Well, Adam, famously, as we know, the Tour de France last finished with a time trial 30 years ago this year, 1989, and it was probably an occasion that won't be matched for drama, because Greg LeMond turned the tables on Laurent Fignon and won the Tour by 8 seconds, closest ever margin in the Tour de France. We'll no doubt be talking about that a fair bit with François Tomazeau during our Tour de France coverage to mark the anniversary of that race. The Giro and, to an extent, the Vuelta have finished with a time trial a lot more regularly than the Tour in the last sort of 30, 35 years. And in fact, in the last two of the last three occasions that the Giro has done so, the lead has changed hands on the final day, sort of serving up some similar sort of drama. In 2012 in Milan, Joaquim Rodriguez lost the pink jersey to Ryder Heisdahl, the Canadian rider. And in 2017, of course, Nairo Quintana lost the jersey to Tom Dumoulin, very much as expected. It wasn't sort of as drama-packed, perhaps, but it was a very last-minute change of hands. No such a prospect of that happening in Verona this year, of course. But you then have to go back in the Giro to 1984, the last time that the lead changed hands in a final day time trial. Laurent Fignon lost to Francesco Moser on that occasion. And so it's one of those things, isn't it, that the time trial can fall a little bit flat if there's nothing hinging on it, I guess. As for the idea of an epilogue, well, the Tour de France back in the sort of 50s and 60s used to have a split stage quite a lot of years. This is before the race finished on the Champs-Élysées. That began in 1975. But before that, when it used to finish in the Parc des Princes and other places, they'd have a short time trial, sort of, 6 or 8 kilometres, and then have a road stage as well. So, yeah, an epilogue idea, that could possibly work.
It's a gamble, isn't it? I mean, it's a measure of how much Christian Prudhomme doesn't like time trials that he hasn't marked the 30th anniversary of the greatest finish ever to the Tour de France with a time trial. And you do, we've thought we would see another one at some point. This seemed this year like the perfect opportunity, but it hasn't occurred. And, you know, although there wasn't much at stake on Sunday in Verona, other than the podium, the final sort of placings on the podium, it was a better sort of showcase spectacle than a flat sprinter stage, to be honest, because, you know, the way that it was set up, with the riders coming into the arena having finished the time trial and being presented to the crowd, and a huge crowd it was. That was wonderful. And I mentioned in Sunday's episode, I sat with the Ecuadorian fans, and it was superb. And we wouldn't have had the same sort of atmosphere if it had been just a sprinter's stage. It was a great opportunity for them to enjoy the whole day and the build up to Carapaz setting off, and you know, his whole ride, which was a promenade for him. I mean, he still obviously had to go very hard, but it was, you know, there would have needed to have been a disaster for him to lose the Giro. So it was pretty much in the bag, and it was a great excuse for them to celebrate throughout his ride and then welcome him into the arena at the end. And it was, you know, very emotional, and I felt you know, an occasion that was perfect, really. And so the time trial, although the race wasn't decided by the time trial, it worked. I think it was you know, everything worked about it. The weather finally was great. The sun was shining. The arena looked magnificent. There was a big pink carpet up to the centre, and it was a really fine way to end the Giro.
Yeah, it certainly looked spectacular on TV, didn't it? It's kind of the similar in a way to the Nîmes time trial that kicked off the team time trial that kicked off the Vuelta,
and much better than the Marseille time trial that ended the tour a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that arena in Verona is you know, well, it's a Roman amphitheater, isn't it? But it is spectacular. I think the World Championships finished kind of just round the corner and down the road a bit the year that Oscar Freire won in '99, because I was there, and I kind of remember. Remember just sort of what a stunning place that arena is. I think, in fact, the press room might have been in the centre in a big tent that year, but much better use of it to actually, you know, obviously the race didn't finish in there, did it? But the riders went in on the pink carpet to a great reception. I thought that the music as Carapaz came in, correct me if I'm wrong, Richard, but I think it was the Kings of Leon, Sex on Fire. I wasn't terribly sure that was the... That was the most appropriate music.
To be honest, I couldn't hear it. You couldn't hear a thing where I was sitting. It was just people singing their own songs. I don't think they would have heard whatever was coming through the speakers because they were creating their own music up there. Shall we move on to the next question?
Hi, guys. Graham from Devon. Love the podcast. Keeps me informed through the stages that I can't watch. I have a question regarding the young riders' standings. We know what sort of rider Miguel Angel Lopez is, but it's regarding some of the other riders, so particularly Pavel Sivakov and Hugh Carthy and Giulio Ciccone, and whether they can come on to be genuine contenders for overall GC, or whether, well, particularly Pavel Sivakov is just going to end up supporting other riders in Ineos, and whether Hugh Carthy will ever challenge for the overall GC. Also, another question regarding a couple of your features. Obviously, you did a feature on Benedetti and some of the teams that hadn't won any stages. And after both of these, they won. Benedetti went on to win a stage, and then Nans Peters of AG2R went on to win a stage. Do you think you should start charging commission to do a feature and potentially bring stage wins to teams? Thanks. Hope to hear an answer. Cheers.
Well, it's a good point about the sort of luck that we seem to bring to certain teams. And Mark Reef in our Kilometre Zero on Friday at the end of the Giro also talked about Chad Haga's prospects in the time trial on the final day. So there was another one that came off, but not sure about the ethics, Lionel, of charging teams to be featured in the podcast. Not sure that would really fly, would it?
Definitely not. No, definitely not. Although, you know, some teams may get so desperate that the offer might become so large that we'd have to, you know, we'd have to get somebody else to say no on our behalf.
No. I don't think so. But I mean, you know, I mentioned on Sunday that one of the highlights for me was Benedetti's stage win, and it was nice that a lot of people who'd kind of heard him and been introduced to him through the podcast were invested in his win because they felt like they knew him a bit and somebody they maybe didn't know beforehand. The question about the young riders, I suppose the Giro and the Tour, the Giro and the Vuelta can be great races for young riders to emerge. And this Giro in particular, actually, with the way that, that things worked out at Team Ineos, for example, it meant that they went there with two young riders, Theo Gegenhardt, who unfortunately crashed out and broke his collarbone, and Pavel Sivakov, had an opportunity to show what they were capable of. And Sivakov really took that opportunity, didn't he? Finishing ninth at the age of 21. And next steps for him are going to be interesting because you would imagine, especially if the rumours are correct that Richard Carapaz is joining Team Ineos, that the next time he rides a Grand Tour could well be in support of a rider. You know, at 21 and next year 22, it's still probably too young to be leading a team into a Grand Tour, despite obviously having the talent to become a leader at some point. Hugh Carthy's a little bit older. There were a few riders up there who are young. Eddie Dunbar rode a good race. He was 22nd in the end. A few promising prospects. Lewis Hamilton, 25th. These are young riders who will, you would think, emerge over the next 3-4 years. But the challenge, I think, for such a young rider as Sivakov is just keeping his feet on the ground. And I don't think that'll be difficult in Team Ineos. If he was in another team, they may well be tempted to promote him to team leader next year, which may well just be a little bit too soon. He's probably still got some learning to do.
Yeah, I don't know how much you spoke to Dave Brailsford about the team selection for the Giro and what they were trying to do, but just in a brief conversation I had with him one morning, he was talking about how this group, this kind of young group, was they were being given quite a bit of freedom to set their own sort of terms. And, you know, he used a phrase, he said, you know, this is your team. You know, Froome and Thomas and co, you know, at the Tour de France, that's kind of their team. But here we don't, they were being quite careful not to just impose, one particular way of doing things on that group of riders. And I thought that was quite interesting. I'm loathe to make sort of football analogies, because somebody will complain.
But you will anyway.
But I'm going to. Just because it struck me as a bit like when a sort of big team plays a kind of a collection of young and relatively untested players in the FA Cup or the League Cup or something. And it had that kind of vibe. There was a freedom and a flexibility that those riders had and took them, certainly Sivakov and Dunbar, made the most of. That opportunity may not come round for them in a Grand Tour again for a wee while. You know, the Tour de France is a completely different beast. Excuse me. And even the Vuelta, you know, the Vuelta will become potentially, you know, somewhere where maybe one of the riders who hasn't had a full look in at the Tour de France, or perhaps somebody, you know, I don't know, I don't want to engage in too much speculation, but with Froome, Thomas and Bernal to all squeeze in somewhere, the young riders may not get another opportunity until this time next year. So it's and with the signing of Carapaz as well, I mean, it does change things. But Sivakov certainly looks like the real deal in terms of the way he raced and the way he kind of hung in there. And you always look with young riders, how do they respond on the days when they're clearly not going as well? The difficult days, do they dig in and limit losses? Do they claw their way back in after getting dropped? And Sivakov did that on a couple of occasions and really rode a proper, solid 3-week Grand Tour, didn't he? Ciccone is an interesting one because he won a stage when he was with Bardiani at Sestola a few years ago, and he's absolutely dominated the King of the Mountains competition at this Giro for Trek Segafredo, got in a lot of breaks, rode extremely aggressively. Whether that is a step on the way to becoming a Grand Tour contender, I'm not terribly sure. And Hugh Carthy, I don't really know what his next step will be. I mean, he kind of faltered at some key points, didn't he? you know, even the day he got the white jersey, he'd lost a little bit of time and was chasing on the flat, and I think lost 40 seconds that day, but ended the day in the white jersey. So that kind of masked the sort of disappointment of actually losing time, because he came out of it with the lead in one of the competitions. Whether he's sort of top five material, I really don't know, but we may find out at the Vuelta.
Well, another guy who had an opportunity was Valentin Madouas from Groupama FDJ. Remember his father, Lionel?
Laurent.
Yeah, Laurent. He was 13th in the end, which is a very, very good ride from a 22-year-old, and came, you know, he was pretty strong in the final week, which again is a good sign. And looking at his results, he was 110th in the opening time trial in Bologna, which doesn't suggest that he was going in with GC ambitions. But a very strong ride from him. I think Ciccone is more of a sort of Alaphilippe type rider, isn't he? Punchy and exuberant and, you know, will win stages. But I mentioned at the start that I spoke to some of the riders who shone at the 2017 Baby Giro. The top four were all riding at the Giro. Pavel Sivakov was the winner, just 7 seconds ahead of Lucas Hamilton and Jai Hindley, who rides for Sunweb. Hamilton rides for Mitchelton Scott, Hindley for Sunweb. And Scott Davis, who was riding for Dimension Data, was fourth in that race. A little bit further down was Mikel Honoré, who was riding this Giro for De Koning Quickstep. I spoke to all of them. I couldn't catch Lucas Hamilton, unfortunately, but you'll hear from the other four in this little montage now.
So I'm Pavel Sivakov. I'm riding from Team Ineos, and I'm 21 years old.
I was going to ask you as well. I was studying the results and noticing that the top four from the Baby Giro in 2017 all riding this race, led by yourself, of course. But did you realise that? And do you feel a kind of a bond with those guys?
Yeah, I've seen that. When I saw the start list. I've seen that I was here, Jai Hindley, Lucas Hamilton and Scott Davis. So that's something special, you know. It means that we are a really good generation, and I think we will be there in the future, in a few years, you know, fighting against each other.
Well, I remember it was very, very tough race, and I was thinking we were only doing maybe 8-9 days, and now could the pros do 3 weeks?
My name is Mikel Honoré, and I'm riding for the Koenig Quickstep.
Yeah, let's say I exceeded some new limits again. But also in the Baby Giro, I finished with bronchitis in the end, so I was, sick, you know, and not feeling too well in the end.
My name's Jai Hindley, and I ride for Team Sunweb. It was a pretty cool race, but it's the baby version for a reason, I guess. Yeah, it was an awesome stepping stone, but this is the real deal, like the next level.
It was really unexpected, because I'd had some virus, which we never really got to the bottom of in April and May. I'm Scott Davis, and I ride for Team Dimension Data. Yeah, I canned all the races in the end, and I just took a few weeks off and just trained, I think, for 5 or 6 weeks. But the Baby Giro was my first race back, so, yeah, a little bit. Went into it without really knowing where I'd be, and then it ended up being probably the result that got me my breakthrough as a pro, really. Got me my contract, so... really good memories, and Italy's just a really nice place to race, especially when the weather's good, and I think you'll probably see that today.
I remember that it was really hard to fight against them, actually, especially Lucas and Jay. They were both riding for the Australian national team, and the fight was on until the last moment. It was just I won just for a couple seconds, so no, it was really nice battle.
For sure, it's a great high level generation, but you see also now, you know, every year I think young guys coming like stronger and stronger, so for sure it's also, you know, let's say all the new science or whatsoever coming to young guys, and yeah, that I think have made a really, really great improvement, like the level from under 23 to the professionals are getting closer and closer. So for sure, you know, the best under 23s are capable of doing really great results with the World Tour.
It's quite a big jump, I mean, for you guys still quite early in your careers, I guess, to all be here running this race together. Do you keep in touch with them? Do you speak to them at all?
Oh yeah, for sure, like say good day in the peloton and Yeah, it's actually quite nice as well, you know, when those guys go well, even though they're on other teams, it's nice to see.
Yeah, exactly. I speak with all of them, to be really. It's even also, yeah, Knox, we talked about a few weeks ago in Finnish in Tulaquila, that we did the same roads, and also one Finnish where we passed Gabice Mare. We also had a Finnish there in 2017, Baby Giro, so it's really fun and great to do the same roads now in the real Giro. Yeah.
And Sivakov has obviously ridden really well. Has that surprised you, or was it obvious when you raced against him back then that he was very talented?
Yes, it's obvious. He's a really talented rider. For me, of course, it's also for himself. I think he's really happy with his. Like, I think now he's top 10, and well, you know, he's always been a really good friend of mine, and I'm really, really, really happy for him because I know how hard he prepared and talked with him already back in Australia this in January that he really wanted to do the Giro, and now seeing him doing so well, I think for sure it's also surprised him, you know.
Yeah, pretty incredible actually. Yeah, hats off to him. Like, he's really riding well. So
did he strike you back in 2017 as somebody who had this great talent?
Definitely. Yeah, I think he's always been pretty good, so no surprises there at all. Yeah,
he's a super talented Sivakov. You know, he's 2 years younger than me, in all fairness, so yeah, he's just solid, you know, consistent, professional. That whole BMC development team, in all fairness, was, you know, they were top, so he's continued his progression really well, and hats off to him because he's had a superb race here, and he really deserves it. So
did you imagine 2 years ago when you were winning Baby Giro that in 2 years time you'd be riding the main Giro?
Nah, really not, especially to finish in top 10, I wouldn't imagine that. So yeah, it's really nice.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by the British Heart Foundation and the London to Brighton bike ride, which is in its 44th year and will be held on Sunday, June the 16th, which is rapidly approaching. But approaching even more rapidly than that is the closing date for entries, which is Wednesday the 5th of June. So that is the last chance to enter the London to Brighton, and you can get £5 off your entry fee by going to bhf.org.uk/L2B2019 and enter the code Brighton5. We'll all be there. Richard, how's your training going?
Come and join us, half wheel us, give us some shelter, whatever. It should be good fun. There's a big team of us doing it. My training has fallen off a cliff having been away at the Giro. I actually weighed myself this morning, Lionel, 4 kilos I've managed to put on over the course of the Giro, so that's not great. I'm gonna get cracking working on that this week, and I'm gonna take my bike on the women's tour as well.
Oh wow! So yeah, well, I managed to keep a bit of weight off by running at the Giro every couple of days, and well, I think it's going to be quite a challenge for me, the London to Brighton. 54 miles long, 17 miles of it are on completely closed roads. It goes over Ditchling Beacon, which I've ridden a couple of times. The first time was actually in the London to Brighton, which I rode in 1990 when I was 14. So I reckon I can go a bit quicker this time than I did then, or maybe not, who knows. But my 1990 effort won't be on Strava, so how will I know? I'll just declare
well,
this.
If it was easy, it wouldn't be worth doing. I think it's going to be a challenge for all of us.
But it's going to be a great day, isn't it? I think the sense of camaraderie and being out in the countryside, heading towards the coast, looking forward to some fish and chips on the beach. Come and join us, bhf.org.uk/L2B2019. You can get £5 off the entry fee with the code Brighton5. Sign up today because closing date is, it's imminent. And if you can't ride, do sponsor us. We're raising money for the British Heart Foundation, a really worthy cause. And if you'd like to support us and support the British Heart Foundation, well, you're not supporting us, you're supporting us not financially, financially, but you're supporting us in the sense of giving us the drive to ride to the coast, go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast.
Hello, it's Neil here from Adelaide. My question is regarding tour debutants. We've seen some excellent debutants this year, the likes of Valentin Madouar, Eddie Dunbar and Lucas Hamilton, who've both featured in the podcast. And I was wondering, who is the best ever performing Grand Tour debutant in the Giro? Thanks very much.
Well, we've been joined by Daniel. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
Best ever debutants in the Giro.
Well, there have been a few winners, haven't there, Rich?
Quite a few, yeah.
Notably in recent years, Quintana,
Indurain. Quintana, Indurain in 92, but he'd already won the Tour. Bernardino as well.
I think as far as riders who were young at the start of their career, who were riding, I think, their first Grand Tour, I think Andy Schleck in 2007
Good
when
show.
He finished second.
Yeah.
And allegedly, supposedly, only stayed in the race after 2 weeks because he'd taken a shine to one of the podium girls. I thought that was quite impressive. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
I just looking up Bernardino's record, and I don't think I'd really appreciated this before, but Eno won the Vuelta, the Giro, and the Tour the first time he rode each race. But his record is unbelievable. He only rode the Vuelta twice, won it twice. He only rode the Giro three times, won it three times. And he finished seven Tours de France and won five and was second in the other two. I mean, absolutely astonishing, really.
And how bad is it?
I don't think I'd really appreciated that. The Badger. He didn't finish one Grand Tour that he started when he had a knee injury in 1980. But kind of gone off topic there. Shall we hear another question?
Hey, Daniel, Richard, and Lionel. This is Rosie from Oakland with a question for the press conference. I'm wondering, who in the top 10 will be riding on a tour? How do you think they'll get on? Thanks so much for what you do. I love your show.
Thanks, Rosie. I think it was Rosie or Rosa. Well, who in the top 10 is riding the tour? Vincenzo Nibali is, and he told Ciro Scognamiglio on the final day of the Giro that he would not be going to the tour.
I don't think he's ruled it out that he'll go for GC. Yesterday, he seemed a little bit more measured about whether he would or wouldn't go for GC.
Roglic is supposedly going to the tour as well. I don't know about that, given the way that his form has tailed off.
Yeah, I think we might see him actually withdraw from the tour. He had the Tour of Romandy, didn't he, just before the Giro. He's been very focused and racing for a long time now.
Mikel Landa? Don't know. We don't know. I don't think so. They're going with Valverde and Quintana, Movistar, to the tour, so I don't think Landa will go to the tour.
Mollema, yes.
Mica, no. Don't think so, because they've got Bora Hansgrohe have got a sort of two Grand Tour teams, haven't they? So they've got Buchmann going to the Tour de France. They've got someone else, Schachmann, Peter Sagan. They've got a sort of embarrassment of riches, really.
Superman,
don't think so. You were talking about Jakob Fuglsang and how he could be a sort of outside threat at the Tour de France. Simon Yates, no.
Yes, Simon Yates,
oh,
yes.
Sorry, this is really good.
I think that he will go to the Tour de France now.
Okay, Sivakov, no. Adam Yates is leading the Mitchelton Scott team.
That's TBC with Simon Yates, but my understanding is that it's very much penciled in for him now.
I mean, the tricky thing this year is there's less time than there was last year between the Giro and the Tour, and when we contemplate it, the Tour is coming down the tracks very quickly, and I think for somebody like Roglic, that will be a factor, because I don't think there's really an opportunity for him to rest and then kind of build up again.
No.
Hi, gents. This is Steve here in very not sunny Perthshire, longtime friend of the podcast, very much enjoying the Giro coverage this year, and in fact, all the race coverage this year has been pretty good fun. The question I'd like to ask is about top tube descending. We see a lot of it in all of the races. We've seen a lot of it in the Giro. Quite often the commentators commentate on how dangerous it is. I believe that you guys have also talked about how dangerous it is. But I was thinking about it, and I can't think of any instances where top tube descending has resulted in a crash. But what with you guys being a lot more knowledgeable than me, you might be able to tell me otherwise. So has top tube descending ever actually cause someone to crash, Or is it maybe just something that we feel is dangerous because it looks weird? Interested to hear what you've got to say. Thanks.
Well, Steve, that's a really good question, and I don't know the definitive answer to it. And I think I don't like it. There's quite a lot. There's a bit of a reaction, isn't there? There are some races where it's been banned, certainly at lower age groups. And I think instinctively it looks dangerous. It looks like the bike isn't balanced, the body's not balanced on the bike, and that a pothole or something in the road could easily tip somebody over. But you're right, I can't think of a case where there has been a crash.
Yeah, I sort of think that riders will only do it, or you know, maybe unconsciously they will only do it when they believe that it's safe enough. There's a sort of, as I say, an unconscious or subconscious self-preservation instinct that takes over and governs these things, I think. I mean, you can also, if you look at, for example, helicopter shots or overhead shots of sprint finishes before wearing helmets was obligatory, you'll see the riders leave bigger gaps in the peloton. They don't get quite as close to the wheel in front. And consequently, the evidence that helmets have or reduced the number of crashes or made things safer in terms of, well, certainly the last 3 kilometres of stages and races is pretty patchy. And I actually think that in some ways it's more dangerous now with helmets because the riders do take more risks.
I think the other fear that you have watching top tube descending is that people who are not as skillful as professional bike riders will copy them.
I think that's valid. Yeah.
Hi guys, it's Isabel from Canada. I'm wondering what Richard's problem is with Miguel Angel Lopez nickname. Last year you guys were looking for a nickname for Yates, saying that you were sad that nicknames were no longer a thing in cycling, but here's a cyclist that does have a nickname, who embraces that nickname, and it seems like at least Richard only mocks it, calling him Spider-Man. Is it just the fact that his nickname is Superman, or is there more to it?
I agree with this call.
Thanks, Isabel. This seems to be addressing me. I mean, if I can't mock a rider being called Superman, then...
But it's a brilliant nickname.
It's a brilliant nickname. Yeah, I mean...
It's the brilliance of this nickname is that it's so incongruous because... you know, he's a super bike rider, but he's also 70 centimeters yeah. tall. And it doesn't look anything like Christopher Reeve or any other incarnations, comic book or otherwise, of Superman.
No, this is true. I mean, you've mentioned before how the nickname came about. He took on some. You mentioned in the podcast that there were potential kidnappers. There were people stealing his bike. Yeah. I think that was a slip of the tongue. People were stealing his bike. He tackled them and wrestled the bike back, and this earned him this nickname. No, I don't have a problem. I do embrace nicknames. There's a bit of debate about this actually with regard to the podcast, because people seem to think, I've noticed on our Facebook discussion group, there's a bit of conversation about this. They thought that we oppose nicknames on the basis that we don't like G for Geraint Thomas. The reason we don't like G for Geraint Thomas is the kind of false intimacy of it. It's not a nickname. It's not a nickname. It's not, you know, the Cobra or the Pirate or the, you know, these great nicknames that have always existed in cycling. Cobra maybe not the best one, but you know, the Eagle, there have been some great nicknames. What's your favorite nickname?
Well, I think currently Superman has to be my favorite, purely because it's almost supplanted his first name. If we see and hear now a lot of Colombian TV and radio crews at the major tours, and they routinely refer to him as Superman Lopez.
Yeah, I mean, the clear distinction here is nicknames are good. We embrace nicknames, we encourage nicknames, but the likes of G and Froomey, they're not in the great tradition of cycling nicknames at all, so we reject those.
I always enjoy an animal one, L'Anguilla di Brembila, Fausto Masnada, the Eel of Brembila, which is the place where he's from near Bergamo. I quite enjoyed that.
Who could forget the flying black pudding?
This is Andrew from Brooklyn, New York. Really love the podcast. Keep up the good work. My question is about World Tour licenses, not so much about the Giro, but in general. If a license were to become available, maybe Dimension Data's, which Pro Continental team do you think would step up and claim it, which would have the budget or the resources to make the jump to the World Tour? Thanks again. Love the coverage. Looking forward to the daily episodes from the Tour de France also.
Who'd be the most likely team? Thank you for the question, Andrew. Who'd be the most likely team? There's a few teams that have expressed an interest in a Pro Continental license.
Yeah, I suppose
Cofidis, Total, Direct Energy.
Yeah, you'd need to distinguish between practically the most likely to take a license and the most deserving in terms of results. I think, like you say, Cofidis and Direct Energy or Total are pretty well equipped. People tend to mock Cofidis, but they've actually turned things around a bit in the last couple of years under the management of Cedric Vasseur. And yeah, they've made more than vague noises about rejoining the World Tour. So I think we could see that happen. Gianni Savio, Androni Sidomé. I mean, he makes vague noises every now and again about moving up to World Tour level. But he's never had a big sponsor come on board to back his project. He's tended to have 24 small sponsors has been his business model. And I don't think it's imminent their graduation to World Tour level, but who knows?
Hi guys, George here. Love the pod. Just had a quick question about Roglic's bike debacle on stage 15. Obviously, Antoine Tolhoek giving up his bike for Roglic makes sense, but it's quite nice to see Movistar's decision to help Tolhoek when he was in trouble with Roglic's bike. I was just wondering if you think there'd be any tactical benefit for Movistar deciding to help Tolhoek, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, with the pedal change, or was it just a decision to help a rider who was struggling? Thanks very much. Bye.
Well, thanks, George. The latter, helping a rider who needed a bike and who is not, he's a helper for Roglic. You do see this from time to time. At the Tour de France last year, Edvald Boasenhagen had a broken bike at the foot of the first summit finish in the Alps, the first of the two stages that Geraint Thomas won, La Rosière, wasn't it, Daniel?
Yes.
And Boasenhagen was left without a broken bike. He was given the spare bike from the Team Sky car, his former team, so he finished on a Sky bike, for which he and Servus Canavan, who was the sports director at Sky, were given fines. Boasenhagen went and found Canavan the following morning and repaid him the €150 that he was fined, which was a nice gesture on his part. But yeah, I think teams will help out other teams in situations like this.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of years ago, Rich, you remember Eduardo Sepúlveda, who was riding at that time? I don't think he was already at Movistar, Fortuneo, I think, the Argentine rider. He was given a lift by the AG2R team car, wasn't he? Remember, he got in the car.
He was thrown off the race for that, however.
Yeah, what were the circumstances there?
Was that not the stage that finished at Mons?
Yes, it was. I think he'd broken a cleat and I think his team car had overtaken him, was another 200 metres or so up the road. Obviously couldn't come back down the course, so he needs to find a way to get up to the team car and he decided to get a lift.
Yeah, that's not strictly allowed. But the teams will help riders on rival teams, and I don't think in any kind of calculating way. The race is obviously at the front with the GC guys battling against each other, but even there I think a team would give a bottle or something to a rider in need.
I mean, I was quite surprised by the reaction to Fran Ventoso giving Vincenzo Nibali a bottle on the Mortirolo stage of the Giro. People were quite taken aback by this, but it's something that happens a lot, particularly with things like gels and bars. Riders will ask each other if they're out of food and they need something. I think it's quite common to ask other riders whether they have anything to spare.
Well, Daniel, shall we let you get off on holiday now? You've put in a big shift on this year's Giro.
Yep.
Enjoy your holiday.
Thank you, Rich. Likewise.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting us and helping us get round the Giro again for the, what is it, fourth year, 16, 17, 18, 19. Very grateful to Science and Sport, and you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That applies only to full price items, so go to scienceandsport.com and fill up with your Science and Sport products. Shall we hear the next question, Lionel?
Hi, this is Sam from Derbyshire. I recently bought a Gruyere tap for my kitchen, and I was wondering if you guys have ever been influenced by cycling marketing, excluding Science and Sport and Rafa, of course. I'm imagining Lionel with a Peugeot, maybe Daniel sending things by US Postal, and Richard getting all his plastics from Ineos. Yeah, thanks. Anyway, enjoying the show.
Well, Sam, a small point of order there. If you bought a Gruyere tap, you should have bought a Hansgrohe tap, obviously. Hansgrohe are sponsors of our Kilometre Zero coverage. But there is, in fact, quite a story about Gruyere and Hansgrohe. It's similar to the brothers, isn't it, who were Adidas and Puma, Adi Dassler and his brother, who split.
An amazing story. It's an amazing story. We were told this story, weren't we, Lionel, when we went to visit the Water Studio in Clerkenwell, which is the Hansgrohe sort of London HQ. And it is a really it's a really interesting story about a family business. Hansgrohe was the founder, and he invented showers and then taps and started manufacturing these. And then his son set up his own showers and taps company called Gruyere. And they became quite in a sort of rivalry, didn't they, the two companies?
They did, but without the animosity of the Adidas Puma situation, which I think degenerated between the two brothers, didn't it? Well, this was a friendly rivalry rather than one with too much needle. But it's an interesting one. Certainly when I was younger, I used to get very excited, you know, as a teenager into cycling, particularly on French holidays. I get very excited about, you know, passing a Castorama, a branch of the DIY store Castorama, because they sponsored a cycling team. I kind of learned about French supermarkets by, Super U had sponsored Laurent Fignon's team before Castorama, actually. And I used to always sort of pester my parents, can we go in Super U rather than one of the other ones? But I don't drive a Peugeot. I'm not sure Daniel posts his stuff with US Postal. Maybe he does. Richard, we should point out Ineos don't manufacture plastic as far as I'm aware, but obviously they have a chemical company. But do you get all your chlorine from Ineos?
I imagine so, Lionel. I don't know. I have no idea. I heard someone from Ineos on the radio yesterday morning, actually, talking about their new facility that they're building, $2 billion investment in Saudi Arabia. But that's probably a story for another day.
Just on that, Jim Ratcliffe is in the closing stages of clinching this deal to buy Nice Football Club in, obviously, you know, play in the French first division. He's adding to his sporting portfolio at quite a pace, isn't he?
He is. I actually heard, a little rumour at the weekend. I heard a couple of rumours, actually, from somebody on another team that, first of all, concerning Ineos, that Dave Brailsford is going to sort of take on a performance director role across the whole sporting portfolio. This is something we've kind of heard rumoured. That will include Nice Football Club, the America's Cup team, the project to try and break the two-hour barrier for the marathon. And the plan apparently originally was that Rod Ellingworth would step up to become sort of the de facto manager, performance director of the cycling team. But Rod Ellingworth handed in his notice just after it was confirmed, or just after it was known within the team that Ineos were going to take over the sponsorship. So that's being, obviously, that's not happening. But Brailsford apparently is being spoken about as a performance director across all the sports, which I think is really going to be interesting and have some implications for the cycling team. I think watch this space. And as far as Bahrain Merida go, where Rod Ellingworth is going. Now, McLaren became a partner in that team this year. And there is a rumour that McLaren will step up and become a sort of title sponsor next year. It could be McLaren Bahrain, perhaps. Who knows? I don't know.
Well, I just hope that when considering Nice Football Club, Brailsford speaks to Gianni Savio about the perfect formation. Maybe are we going to see Nice all just lining up in one line and just walking the ball up the middle of the pitch?
He may well install Gianni Savio as manager of the team. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, certainly knows how to get in a breakaway, doesn't he, old Gianni Savio?
So I'm
not
does.
Sure if that can be applied to football. But I think we all, certainly from the days that we got into cycling, and, you know, I suppose the world has changed a lot and now it's all multinational corporations. But in the days when I started following cycling, companies were quite local. And so the names on the cycling jerseys were complete. It just added to the exotic appeal of cycling because I didn't know any of the names. They were all unfamiliar to me. And they had a sort of glamour to them that wasn't perhaps appropriate for a cement company or a you know, liquid gas company. But that liquid gas was a little bit later on. But yeah, and I mean, so many of the sponsors though have stuck around for so many years in cycling, and you know, Lamprey and companies like that have been in different teams, sponsoring different teams at different times, and a lot of Spanish companies as well, Tika and you know, Seat and Sur, and a lot of kind of manufacturers there in Spain of fridges and white goods.
Do you not get a frisson of excitement? I mean, even at the Giro, driving around, you know, if you see a big billboard on the side of the road for Chateau Dax, I just think of Gianni Bugno and
Mercatone,
you know, Mercatone Uno. Well, we actually passed the headquarters of Mercatone Uno on, it's a sort of medium-sized sort of tower block type thing by the motorway somewhere up the middle of Italy, and I saw it and said to Daniel, is that the actual headquarters of Mercatone Uno, sponsor of Pantani's team, of course? In
the one that always sort of takes me by surprise in France is you still see little Lavie-Clair shops.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, Lavie-Clair were this, you know, super stylish, very, well, elegant jerseys, and this behemoth, albeit only for a couple of years, but this super team, you know, the team Sky of its day, if you like. You know, when you now see a Lavie-Clair shop, it's a little pokey little kind of herbal kind of health shop. Mm. It doesn't really fit with the image that I have of Lavie-Clair, the cycling team. No. There you go.
Well, Lavie-Clair was succeeded by Toshiba, weren't they? That would have been the very early 90s, I think, maybe the late 80s.
Late 80s,
87, 88, yeah. And when my football team, Watford, in the early 2000s were sponsored by Toshiba for a couple of years, it was like kind of worlds colliding. I was absolutely thrilled that, you know, there's a link between the two.
On the subject of sponsorship, Lionel, let's hear a little interview I did with the owner of the Mitchelton Scott team, Gerry Ryan, because a lot of questions around that team. They were Orica Scott until a couple of years ago, of course. And sorry if there's some noise in the background here. A lot of building work going on around me at the moment. But anyway, Gerry Ryan has been the main sort of sponsor, funder. Mitchelton is another of his companies. Pretty much all the names you see on that jersey over the years have been owned by him, with the exception of Orica and obviously Scott. But I just wonder, you know, they really do need a title sponsor that's not one of his companies, I would think. I'm not sure how his children feel about him spending all of his money on a cycling team. So I spoke to him when I saw him at the start. I can't even remember where we were now. Sorry, Feltre, I think it was, on the day after Esteban Chavez won his stage. So I asked him first about that because I'd seen him greet Chavez's parents who were there, and I could see real affection between them and a real feeling of you know, them being part of his extended family, if you like. So I asked him first about Chavez's stage win, and then about you know, what the prospects were of finding an additional sponsor, a title sponsor for the team. So a great day. Yes, I saw you celebrating Esteban's mother just there. You must have enjoyed that yesterday.
It was just great to see the champ, as I call him, back. You know, it's been a struggle for him, you know, but he's been building. The boys were very patient and just said, hey, ride into it, and a second, then a first. So it's a great effort.
So, yeah, the team is obviously something you've been heavily involved and invested in for many years. It bears the name Mitchelton, which is one of your companies. I know that you're looking for additional sponsorship. Is there any progress on that front?
Yeah, it's been, we've had our best interest ever, and over the next 3 weeks, we've got several appointments. We've had several. No, it's very exciting. So, once again, it'll help us grow as well.
Is it essential that another sponsor comes in, or can you keep your involvement going?
No, I can keep the involvement going, but the extra sponsorship will assist us becoming a bigger and better team.
So there's no danger to the team. It will carry on, but the additional sponsorship is kind of important.
Oh, it's certainly going to assist us, as I said, to grow the team.
So that was Jerry Ryan, the owner of the Mitchelton Scott team, who does say that he is prepared to keep spending his money on the team, that there is no threat to the team. But I think a title sponsor is necessary. And one rumour that I've heard is that the Colombian sponsorship that was rumoured to be a possibility for replacing Sky, there is interest in Colombia, apparently, and it may well end up supporting the Mitchelton Scott team. And that may also be why Esteban Chavez's victory was very important. Who knows? Let's see what happens.
Hello, chaps. It's Moin Islam from London, long-time friend of the podcast. Had a question about the route of the Giro. There's been a lot of discussion about the route not being conducive to racing, and also some discussion that Daniel had mentioned on a couple of occasions about last-minute alterations to the route because some of the local provinces, or I think regional governments, stepped back from hosting Giro. Does Daniel know what the actual original planned route was? And if so, and I know this is terrible speculation, would he have expected the result to have been any different? Because we often say that the parkour suits certain riders, but then at the end of the day, we almost always say, well, the strongest rider won with the strongest team, etc., etc. So, you know, would be interested in your views on this and what it might look like. The Giro coverage was spot on, absolutely wonderful for what was, I guess, a little bit of a tepid edition, but it can't be great all the time, eh? Keep up the good work. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, good question, Moin. Daniel obviously mentioned a few episodes ago that the original plan had been for the start of the Giro to be in Matera, down in Puglia, sort of in, well, where is that? It's kind of in the heel, isn't it, of Italy. And it certainly, well, we don't know the full consequences of the start moving to Bologna, but that will have had quite a significant effect on the race. And I suppose the bit of the course for me that fell flattest was the two incredibly flat stages after the first rest day, sort of straight up the middle, you know, in a straight line with really nothing about them at all. That really sort of sucked the life out of the race a bit for me after it just threatened to sort of get going with the time trial shaking things up. And I mean, you didn't have to be a genius to work out that would be the consequence of those two stages, really. There was going to be nothing of great significance happening on those 2 days. We were fortunate in a way that from the podcast point of view, we were able to look at other things and tell other stories. We went to the Marco Pantani Museum a couple of days before that. The stage that went to Novi Ligure was obviously all about, you know, Fausto Coppi's legacy. So there were things around the race that were of interest. And, you know, there were a couple of interesting stories with the sprints, the way that Groupama FDJ set up Demar and Caleb Ewan winning his second sprint, and obviously Elia Viviani finishing empty-handed. But it really kind of, it sucked the race down a bit. And although the next 4 days, Richard, when you joined us back out in Pinerolo and we had the win for Benedetti and that kind of amazing finish, and then we really had a couple of good GC days. And now when we look back, you know, the stage de Courmayeur that Richard Carapaz won, you know, was the kind of defining one of the race, really. The final week didn't really deliver either. And possibly because, you know, it was it was hard. The length of the stages was, you know, significant. You know, a couple of them that were sort of 200 plus kilometers long, perhaps put the fear into people, and they were kind of on their last legs by the last day. So in terms of, you know, what the route might have been, I don't know. But at the end of the race, Daniel's verdict, which he expresses in wine glasses, he gave it 2 wine glasses out of 5, which I think is just about right. I mean, my way of looking at it is it was like a pizza with only one topping, you know, pepperoni, a nice topping in places, but it all slipped over to one side as well.
I mean, if you're only gonna have one topping, presumably the tomato and mozzarella's taken as red.
Taken as red. And then if you're only gonna
have one topping, then make it pepperoni, I would suggest.
But it could have been Indugia sausage, you know.
Imagine if it was capers or something.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, during the Giro, I had what turned out to be a large slice of onion pizza, just onion. It was better than that. The Giro was better than that slice of onion pizza. Yeah. But
I can't think of a Giro that's been an onion pizza. But anyway, it's a really interesting question, though. To what extent does the route determine the winner? And that there's no way of knowing. I mean, there is literally no way of knowing.
Well, the thing is, every year the route determines the winner, doesn't it? I mean, by definition, I guess.
Well,
but
kind of.
I know what Moyen's getting at. I think,
you know, going back to an earlier question, we don't, you know, this idea that the easiness of the first half of the race, what effect that had on riders' form and condition, we don't know. And we can't know, really. But whether that was a factor in Sam Yates not performing, we just don't know. And whether, you know, somehow Richard Carapaz was able to cope with that better, who knows? I guess we'll find out over the next few years as we see how he performs in other Grand Tours as well. Can I just go back to the bit that I did with Daniel earlier? Because inevitably we've got some corrections.
Of course.
I can't really remember what we said, but one of the questions was about who of the top 10 would go on and ride the Tour de France. I think I can't even remember what my answer was, because this was yesterday, and that's a long time at the moment. But Bauke Mollema is going to the Tour, and so is Mikel Landa, which I'm quite surprised about. Landa says he wants to go to the Tour as well. Mm. So that's going to be an interesting... It's the Trident once again at Movistar. Mm. Another thing, we were asked a question, Lionel, about nicknames, and I was challenged on my opposition, apparently, to Superman. I don't object to that at all as a nickname. I find it funny. The nicknames I object to are nicknames derived just from names, such as Froomey or G, and another one I thought was Big Mig.
Miguel Indurain.
Never like that. That was just poor. The best nickname, which I neglected to mention earlier, is the Badger, of course, you know.
Mm. So you're okay with nicknames that are somehow sum up a rider's character or have
character,
some kind of,
and especially as Daniel said, derive, you know, link them to an animal, the shark, you know. I love it when Ciro doesn't call Vincenzo Nibali, but just the shark. You know, I think that's great. And Eno, similarly, the Badger. You know, imagine doing the podcast when the Badger was in his pomp. You'd never need to use the words Bernard Eno, would you?
So the distinction really is nicknames that are kind of bestowed on riders by, I guess, by the sort of the newspapers. Are fine. Whereas it's sort of the matey kind of what the riders call each other. Froomey,
I think Big Mig is the worst of all time.
Well, because it wouldn't work in Spanish, would it? I mean, it's a kind of an anglicized thing.
The Angel of the Mountains,
wonderful.
The Cannibal, the Badger, the Shark,
all perfectly fine.
And Superman, we welcome these. Anyway,
the Buffalo, of course.
Yeah, we should bring our Giro coverage finally to an end 48 hours after the end of the Giro. It's been great, I think, and we, as you say, Lionel, the Tour de France is fast approaching. But first, we've got the Women's Tour, and we'll be doing a preview episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina this week, and going into daily coverage from the Women's Tour next week, which I'm very much looking forward to.
I'll be listening. Have a nice time. Great.
Thank you. And thank you, Lionel. And thanks once again to you, the listeners, and to the sponsors who've enabled us to cover the Giro in such depth. Rafa, Science and Sport, and Hansgrohe for supporting Kilometre Zero. And just before we go, another thank you to some of the friends of the podcast whose support we greatly appreciate, and who, by becoming friends of the podcast, can listen to our exclusive friend specials. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. And among those who have, a big thank you to Peter Stewart, James Mackey, Kate Cowie, David Campion, Alina Nettleton, Simon Bowers, Mark Morgan.
And thank you to David Boyle, Alex Hamer, Nicola Munro, Stephen Webb, Graham Bird, Joanna Whiteley and Sarah West. Thank you very much for your support.
Allo marito mio, faccio l'invito, denna cantina esse, denna cantina esse. Allo marito mio, faccio l'invito, denna cantina esse. A casa morre ad ucciso, apri mogliere mia, non si ritira a casa, morre ad ucciso, apri mogliere mia, e fammi col caso, cozze ci delle cozze, cozze di scinde, non spigo de cicora, cozze ci delle cozze, cozze di scinde, non spigo de cicora. Non voglio che te apro, che sta stizzata, ed è che non mi dici, ed è che non mi dici. Non voglio che te apro, che sta stizzata, ed è che non mi dici. Don caso di stato,
lo stato alla cantina, cazzo stato, lumi e ruga maccodo, lumi e ruga maccodo, su stato alla cantina, cazzo giugato, lumi e ruga maccodo, e mangio un brigato,
cozze ci delle cozze, cozze vicine, non spico de cicora, non spico de cicora. Forse ci delle cozze, cozze vicine, non spicu de cicora, se non mangia lune femmine. Non spicco de cicora, cozze ci delle cozze, cozze vicine, non spicco de cicora, se lo mangiano le femmine.
Cicerella te devo giardina che la raccolgo con l'acqua e lo vino.
Cicerella, uè,
e l'ore bella.
Cicerella, uè,
e l'ore bella.
faceva l'uovo tutte le mattine, ci c'era in alla della mammalina, faceva l'uovo tutte le mattine. Ci c'era nella tenne matiella, faceva l'uovo con la mozzarella. Ci sono della teneva mallina, faceva l'uovo tutte le mattine.